Good morning to everybody. You look like a friendly group. I hope that you are. I assume that you are. It's good to see such a sizable group of singles. I imagine, I didn't hear whether Mr. Weber mentioned the numbers here. It looks to be about 700-800, something like that. I was in Toronto, Ontario, Canada 2 weeks ago for a singles weekend, and they had about 550 there, and I thought that was a huge group, but you're even bigger. You don't look any friendlier than they did, though, because they look very friendly, and so do you. I imagine most of you expect me this morning to talk about some aspect of the singles lifestyle, you know, maybe the differences between men and women, or dating, or problems you have in relationships between one another, things of that type. And you may be upset because I'm not going to do that at all. I won't even get near that particular topic, in fact. In some ways, and this is just a personal reaction, I think we have perhaps, at times at least, over-analyzed our singles. Maybe that's why you look the way you look, I don't know. friendly. But sometimes we do that. We just sort of tell you, you know, day in, day out, who you are and what you are and what the opposite sex is like, and you hear this continuously to the extent that sometimes we may even focus almost obsessively on our status as non-marrieds or singles or that type of thing, to the exclusion of the rest of the congregation. Many of you perhaps have never done that, but I think some of you possibly have, and we just sort of go through this time and time and time again. With that in mind, I thought I would broaden the scope a little bit into another area. In fact, go to the other end of the spectrum. I think you'll see what I'm saying before I finish this morning. My basic purpose, and this is a broad general overview of it, my basic purpose is to discuss a little bit about success as a person, but in a specific, focused way. I want to talk a little bit about success as a Christian, and in that sense, as a single as well. And we'll lay a kind of a foundation. It will not be the foundation that you perhaps expect, but I think you'll see that it should be a basic part of your life. I teach a class in Ambassador College called Introduction to Leadership, which is designed to give students in AC some background in terms of becoming a leader or a success in life after graduation, a success in their local congregation, and success as well in various aspects of their life. And in so doing, I lay a foundation similar to the one I want to lay this morning. The underpinning of any office that you may have, an office in the church, an office in the secular world, a job, a responsibility, the underpinning, if it involves leadership, should be an attitude of service. And service guarantees success. I don't care what you're doing, you can use that as an axiom. Service guarantees success. That's the law of God. Those who lead must view themselves as servants of those who are led. Otherwise, you have a kind of a dictatorship, and the troops become unsettled, and they don't like you, and you have a lot of problems. Now, in the Church of God, coming back to that, it's important that the ministry view themselves as servants of the brethren. We have authority, and we are in charge when we're placed over a congregation. But we also have to understand people, analyze people, love people, and want to serve people. And there have been times in our history when that focus perhaps has not been there quite as strongly as it needed to be. And we're all aware, if we go back a certain number of years, of certain problems that have occurred because of that. That principle, however, applies to any job that you might have. You see, even in the secular world, most of you are not employed by the Worldwide Church of God, but some of you that I know are. Most of you aren't. If you're in real estate, when you sell a house, or you're trying to sell a house to a client, you need to view yourself as a servant of the client. He will soon figure out your reaction to him. You're his servant or her servant, and you will find the relationship will go quite nicely. And if they sell a house again in 5 years down the road, they'll tend to come back to you. Over the years, the first time I bought a house was in 1971. I was up in Montreal, Canada. And I listed with an agent, And the day after I listed with him, he left on a vacation to the Bahamas for a month. You know what that meant? He didn't work in my house for a month. And it sat there with a sign in front of it that the agent was out of town. I was understandably somewhat upset. He was not my servant. I won't go into the long, long story of the next agent that I got who retired from the business 3 days after he took my listing. He simply, yes, but I couldn't get out of the, you know, the listing for a month, for 6 weeks. That was the law, that he was no longer an agent. I could have wrung his neck. If I were to sell the, I live in a condominium in Pasadena. None of us can afford houses in this town. So we live in condos and places like that, by and large. If I were to sell it again, I mean, I'd check out these agents. I'm not looking for a church member necessarily, you see. I'm just looking for an agent who will, at least on a secular level, view himself as a servant. Most agents don't. And I run from those people, you know, 100 miles an hour. But some few will. If you're a car mechanic and you got a business in a small town and you got two other, you know, people who are mechanics as well, if you begin to stand out as the servant of the people whose vehicle you are repairing, they'll respond to service, whether they're church members or not. It's an automatic law of God. Service generates respect. Service generates a response. Service generates, with time, success, no matter what you do. And you can make that a kind of a principle to build your life on. I'd like you to look at something in Mark chapter 9, which focuses primarily on the church, admittedly, and growth as leaders within a local congregation. But the principle certainly applies on a broader basis to any job, any responsibility that we have. God doesn't change. Mark chapter 9, verse 35. Jesus sat down and called the 12 and said unto them, verse 35, Mark 9, if any man desires to be first. Now, in the context, I know he meant in the church, but he didn't specify that, so we can broaden out the principle. If any man desires to be first, this is success in a broader sense, the way we'll apply it this morning. The same shall be last of all, that is, in his attitude. He has ambition, he has aspirations, he wants to succeed in life. He must become last of all in his attitude, in his heart, and a servant of all that he's involved with. Now, in the class that I teach, my aim is to attempt to teach Ambassador College students how all-encompassing the word all is. In this context, the servant of all, not just the servant of his particular group, you see. If you're single, not just the servant of the singles. If you're married, not just the servant of those who are married. We discuss the word all and try to break it down, and there's so many categories. We talk about how to serve little kids, because there is a way you serve children. If you've never had kids, if you're single and you're, you know, before I was married, I felt awkward around little children. I was not automatically, I was not necessarily highly paternal as a single guy. I became paternal as my children arrived, and I view myself as paternal now, but when I was 22, I don't think I was. Little kids sort of scared me. I didn't know. They just seemed to yell and scream and pull at you and stuff. And I didn't know how to react to all of that. There is a way to serve little children. There's a way to serve people who are physically handicapped. We talk about that somewhat. There's a way to serve those who are deaf, those who are blind. They have different needs. There's a way to serve people who have personality defects, people who are depressed or are depressives. There's a way to serve the elderly. And we talk about all of these categories. I try to focus an attitude of service on all of these categories. And then we lay a foundation by so doing for success, you see. Success as a graduate, success in a local congregation. I bumped into people in local congregations who don't know how to be a success, who don't know how to deal with people, who don't understand people. And we need to have that. Today, I can't go through all of those categories. I thought because you're singles, and let's say you lean towards the 20s, 30s, and 40s, in terms of medium age, though a few of you look like you're leaning towards the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but I'd say by and large, you're more in the early stages of life. I thought I would take your focus and throw it over to the, you know, other side of life, the other end of the spectrum. We're going to talk about the elderly. Now that may seem strange. You come to a singles activity and we're going to talk about the elderly. Well, you'll meet those folks when you go back home next week. They'll be there at Sabbath services next week. This week, the peers. This week, the other singles. This weekend, a focus on people probably so much your own age. That's great, no problem at all. But when you get back, remember you have to have a divided focus. You're to serve all. That includes this particular category. I choose the elderly because I think they're the most interesting of all the categories included in the word all. I have chosen them because they're extremely important to God, but not always as important to us as they should be, but they are to God. And I choose them because they probably are the least familiar to most of you. Now, if you are yourself 73, these people are quite familiar to you because they're your peers. But most of you are not in that age bracket. They are the least familiar to most of us. When you're 25 or 35 or 43, you do tend to focus on your peers. That's normal. We, in fact, encourage that in the church, and that's one reason why you're here. But if you want God's blessing on your life as you start out in life, and you're in a kind of a launch mode, that is, if you're in your 20s and 30s, you're launching. You're launching out. You're probably launching in the church because you may have been baptized 5 or 10 years. You're not a 40-year member of the church. I'm a 32-year member of the church in terms of years baptized, so I'm not a new member. Many of you are not even 32 years old, so you're not an old member in many cases. In a few cases, you are. But as you launch out, you have to set aside a certain amount of time to serve people of senior citizen age. And if you don't do that, God withdraws certain blessings and He won't be with you as you begin unless you spend some time with those who are finishing up. I'd like to do a quick survey. How many of you still have living grandparents? Can I see some hands? So I see if I have... that's very good. Thank you. That's, I would say, 80% of you, maybe 85. Any of you have living great-grandparents? That might be more interesting. Great-grandparents. It's about 10 or 12 of you. Any of you have living great-great-grandparents? Two greats? Could happen, though it's rather unusual. We don't have any 10-year-olds here. And sometimes people in that category do. Those of you who raised your hands have a special opportunity. Because you're already faced with a situation I'll describe in the Bible study this morning. How many of you live within driving distance, an hour to an hour and a half, maybe a couple hours of the grandparents you just mentioned you still have? Thank you, I'm not surprised. You know why? When I asked that question in Canada, all the hands that went up the first time went up the second time. Isn't that interesting? This is Southern California. This is the Southwest. Most of your grandparents are back in the Midwest or some other part of the country, or they're over in Tucson in a senior citizens village. And you live here perhaps in Southern California or in the Bay Area or whatever. A relatively small number of you put your hands up there. That means you have a bit of a problem. It'll cost some money to fulfill what I'm going to talk about, but that's okay. Telephone calls, letters, trips, they can be expensive. But when you got to carry out what God says, then you have to sort of live with that. The point is this. As we begin our lives, we do tend to neglect those adults who are coming to the end of their active life. Many of you are launching into your active life. And that is your focus. And you enjoy other people that are active, you see, and lively, and that are talking about getting jobs and going here and moving there. The folks who are less active, less lively, who have retired and don't even have jobs in many cases, or talk about jobs they used to have 20 years ago, are not that fascinating. When you have that kind of attitude towards the elderly, you cannot expect God to be particularly generous with you. He will not be. That's something to think about. You cannot expect God to bless your plans for life. And when you're in a launch mode, you've got plans. You have a business you'd like to start. You have, you're in a company, you'd like to move up in it. You want God to grant you success. There are certain things you have to do, obviously. The seven laws of success, you know all about those. I'm sort of trying to give an overview of what those seven laws say on a personal level. God blesses servants, and in particular, He puts unusual focus on servants of the elderly. James chapter 1, you've read this before, but I'll reread it very quickly. So you get the overview again. James chapter 1, verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this. And this is the nitty-gritty. And this is something we avoid, because how many of us get right down to pure religion all that often? To visit the fatherless and the widows. Visit means to take the oversight. It's a stronger verb than the old verb just to visit somebody. It means to get involved with the fatherless and the widows when they're really feeling good, when their minds are sharp, when they're, as alert as a tack, when they don't need any help at all, and they're lots of fun, and they're young for their age. Then you visit the elderly. But it doesn't say that. It says widows in their affliction. You get that picture, do you? That is, maybe not so sharp, maybe not so active, maybe not a lot of fun sometimes, maybe a little tired with life, maybe a little rambly. And God says you get involved with people, and then you keep yourself unspotted from the world. It is in some ways easier to keep ourselves unspotted from the world than it is to get involved with these particular groups of people in their afflictions. God says that's something we have to do. In fact, Exodus 22 is a kind of a, well, more than an exhortation. You'll see some priorities set here by God. Chapter 22, verse 21, very strong statement given by God. And we'll see some things about life, about success in life, even about marriage. Even about marriage. And there's some interesting statements made by God. Verse 21, Exodus 22. You shall neither vex a stranger, that is, in modern parlance, you shall not vex an immigrant who comes into the land and is fleeing perhaps persecution or economic disaster in his nation. Don't vex them, God says. Don't harass them. That has happened in our land at times. It's happened in all nations. Don't oppress them, for you were strangers once. You were immigrants in the land of Egypt. You went down into Egypt because there was no food in your land, and there were famines. And you've had that experience, and you should know what it's like, God says. And verse 22 talks about another vulnerable group. You shall not afflict any widow or a fatherless child. Widows being primarily elder women or older women. It can include older men, of course. But the interesting thing is, in our nation of Israel, there aren't that many older men. Men tend to die in their 60s. That's simply, my father was 65 when he had a heart attack. That's not unusual. Most of my uncles died in their 60s. Most of my aunts are still alive. Many of them are in their 80s and 90s. And one lived until she was almost 100. But they all outlived their husbands by 10, 15, 20, 25, even 30 years. Why is that? Now, you know, one thing interesting, brother, and I'd like you to think about this. I go to Italy a lot. You know one thing I notice when I'm in Italy? Lots of old men. Lots of elderly ladies, too. Lots of elderly couples. You go to a park in Italy, and you'll see these rows of old men in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, talking, enjoying life. Why is it so hard in Israel, the USA, England, Canada, to find any number of elderly men? That's because most of them are dead, you see. Men die young in Israel. Why do they live longer in many Gentile countries? Is there something to be learned, something to be thought? You have to admit it's true. Even in the Church of God, in the bracket of people in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, 80 to 90% are women. That isn't bad. But we have to analyze why this is the case in our nation, that you go to Italy, and all these little old Italian guys in their 80s, you know, walking down the street, enjoying life, playing cards, doing what men of age should be doing. Why do they live longer in some countries? I'll read this through and see if you can do some analysis. Verse 23, don't afflict the widows. Don't afflict the elderly, God says. Don't ignore the elderly. Don't throw them aside. If you shall afflict them in any wise, and they cry out unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will be hot. Now this is a collective national thing. And I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children shall be fatherless. That's an overall thing. That's an overview and a collective thing. It is simply a fact that in nations in which the elderly are honored and loved and respected and looked after, that the elderly will tend to live a whole lot longer. A lot longer. Into a great old age. And elderly men will live longer. It's hard to be 65 and not have any respect. Nobody cares much about you. A lot of men simply give up sooner. And women hang on longer. There's a lot to be said about that. And something you need to think about. God becomes angry. when nations collectively neglect certain categories. And in the middle right here, when you read this, you find the elderly, along with fatherless children and those who come into our nation from other nations and are particularly vulnerable because of their newness or the fact that they've had to leave everything behind them. In our nations, in Israel in general, there are a few exceptions perhaps, people just sort of chuck the elderly to the side and send them off to hospices and old folks' homes and things of that type. Now, that can't be helped, and sometimes that has to be done, and I realize that. But that isn't the way things are viewed in a lot of other countries by any means. In our nations, people tend to check on old folks once or twice a year. I see maybe some of you do this, you know. Thanksgiving, they drive 50 miles and bring grandma home for Thanksgiving. And then they say goodbye for another year. And then a year later, they go get grandma again for Thanksgiving. She may not be all that thrilled. We often act as if they don't exist. And it often is not important to us to be near them, to spend time with them, to call, to phone, or to do things of that type. That neglect, which is what God is talking about here in the book of Exodus, creates a trauma in elderly people, a deep-seated psychological and emotional frustration. And we'll talk about this in a couple of minutes more at length, and we'll tell you what your job is, because you're commanded by God to get rid of that psychological and emotional sense of frustration. God says you do something for them, you take that away from them, and you can make old age a much happier time for people going through that particular experience. Leviticus 19 tells you how to start doing it. Leviticus 19 gives you the basic context. And here really is the foundation. In dealing with the elderly, the foundation is in this particular verse. It tells you the style you have to adopt. Leviticus 19, verse 32. It says, "You rise up before the hoary head." Now, that was perhaps a cultural pattern in that day and age when a person of age walked by and white hair was considered to be a distinctive sign of age. People would automatically rise and stand. I don't know if God necessarily expects us to stand up every time a person of age comes into the room. I certainly know this much. He does expect us to show visible, automatic deference to them. And you can read this and analyze how you feel you should react to people of age. Rise up before the hoary head, and notice, honor the face of the old man. That's sort of hard to do in Israel because most old men are not alive. That's part of our national sin and our national problem. You go to Italy, you can find lots of old men whose face you can honor. If your grandfather is still alive, or perhaps you're in your 50s and your father is in his 80s, you have a great blessing because you can keep a law that some people in the hall today can't even keep because nobody in their family is of this age. But of course there are other people around us, elderly in the church, elderly in the neighborhood. Honor the face. It's harder to do when you don't live within driving distance, isn't it? See, it doesn't just say send them letters. Elderly people relate well to letters and phone calls, but the most meaningful thing is a one-on-one, face-to-face contact where you talk to them and they talk back to you, and the law says honor the face of the old man. And I can't do a lot about that because that's exactly what it says. It's interesting, the end of this verse I like, because after God could have put a period there and said, you know, that's it. But then he says, and fear your God. That's an indication God sort of realized we probably wouldn't do this very easily or quickly, so he sort of added a kind of an exclamation point. He said, fear your God. Now, he could have put a period there too and thought that was enough, but he obviously felt that wasn't sufficient either. So he then adds, I am the Eternal. Do you get the point? That is, this is what God, this is what you would call emphasis. You know, they didn't have exclamation points in the Hebrew as we do. They had to add a little phrase to make it as strong as it could possibly be made. So rather than exclamation points, you have, fear God, I am the Eternal. In other words, honor them or else you're in trouble. That's really what God is saying. When God puts emphasis on a law and we don't do it or we give it short shrift, we deprive ourselves of blessings. We're not going to be extremely successful in life. And if you're launching out, you have to view yourself as a servant. a servant of all. And God says, in particular, a servant of those of age who are, first of all, members of your own physical family, and then members of your spiritual family, and then even elderly people in the neighborhood. Because when this law was given, you see, there was no church. This applied to every single elderly person on the face of the earth, and in effect, in the broader sense, still does. Why is honor so vital to the elderly? And why does God feel so strongly about it? In other words, is it just for your benefit, or is there something in this for their benefit? The answer is this, brethren. We've been designed by God in such a way that we automatically begin to need honor, and maybe that's not strong enough, to crave honor as we move into the final stage of our life. And then it gets stronger and stronger. So it's in large measure for them because the elderly need it. Now, when you're 18 or 25 or 30 or 35, and many of you are in that age bracket, honor and validation isn't all that important. I realize that. It's nice to have somebody pat you on the back and say, hey, you've done a good job. And that feels good. But, it's not a prerequisite. It's nice, but it's not a prerequisite. To the elderly, it is far more than nice. It is a prerequisite for them. As you move into your 50s, and that's where I am in life, it becomes more and more important to be validated for who you are, but more than anything else, for what you've done. Because in your 50s, you already have most of your professional life behind you, at least in this society, and you know that. And you hopefully, if you have a business or whatever, you're moving into the time when, you are a success, or at least are getting close to it. It's important to be validated for what you've accomplished. As people move into their 60s and 70s, the need becomes even more powerful. As people move into their 70s and 80s, it can, in some cases, be the only great emotional need, even on beyond the need for physical affection. That is there too. But this need can become very powerful. And please remember, brethren, it was placed there by God. It isn't something they just sort of fall into because, you know, they get into that time in life. It was established by God that we go through that phase of life. It was placed there by God to help us reach a sense of completion. And there is a point in time, beginning in the 50s into the 60s and 70s, when you want to tie up the loose strings, when you want to come to a sense of peace with what you have done in life, and I simply call it completion or closure. You recognize that. At my age in life, frankly, I am more aware of my mortality than I was when I was 25. Because I'm 3/4 of the way, or 2/3, to my, 3 score and 10. And I have friends of mine that I went to school with, high school and whatnot, even some in Ambassador College, who are on the edge of considering retirement. People a little bit older than I am, but who went to college with me. Some of them are retiring from their job. Some of them have already died in their 50s and early 60s. And so I'm conscious of that too. So closure becomes something in your mind. There are a lot of things you got to finish off. And honor is a part of that. When the need is fulfilled, I'll tell you something. The elderly blossom, and I want to give you some examples in a minute. They will be happier. When the honor is denied them, old age can become a miserable, sad, frustrating experience. And elderly denied this become automatically cranky, crusty, hard to deal with, angry, depressive, and a lot of other negative things. And my own personal theory is they can move into a state of, let's call it premature senility, much more easily when the honor is not there. They simply give up and they stop thinking about life. Depression sets in, and then, they begin to have certain other problems. All of us have dealt with elderly people who are just sort of cranky and abrasive. You know, when I was a little kid, you ride your bike down the sidewalk. And I remember very clearly the fourth house down, there was an old lady, as I would have called her then, an elderly woman, probably in her 70s. If the kids rode by on their bikes, she'd come running out of her house, yell at them, tell them to get away from her house. And we called her the witch. She was unhappy and sad, cranky, probably on the edge of senility, I would rather imagine. I'm sure nobody had ever honored her a day in her life. On the other hand, right across the street was another little old lady who would call all the kids into the house and give them cookies. She tried to make up for her peer across the street. And she was wonderful. She loved all the kids. As I remember, she also had a lot of children herself who came by to see her frequently, and you know, her life was full of honor, and she reflected that. Why is the suicide rate of people over 70 the highest of any age group in the USA? It is not teenagers. They're the second highest suicide rate. The highest, people over 70. Why is that, brethren? Why do they have problems with depression? Why do those things happen? Without honor, as you get older, life becomes more and more futile. But if you do get your measure of honor, life becomes happier. And old age becomes a time of fulfillment and closure in a right way. Things are closed off, you see. Things are completed. Everything is brought together. And there is a sense of peace that is created when honor is given. I want to tell you about the first time I met Ken Russell. Mr. Russell, when I first met him, was in his 70s, late 70s. That was about 10, 11, 12 years ago. A few of you here remember Mr. Russell. First time I saw him, he was not a church member then. He was interested. He had eyes, the tired, sad eyes that never seemed to smile. I remember that so clearly because his eyes struck me. They showed incredible sadness. He was extremely overweight. His skin was yellowed. His body had been devastated by years and years and years of chronic alcoholism, and you know what that does to the coloring of your skin and that type of thing. During the first contact, I found out that booze had wrecked his marriage back in the 40s, his only marriage, the one time he had been able to be married. It robbed him of the respect of his kids. He lived in a shack on his daughter's property in San Bernardino County. But she didn't have much to do with him. She had given him, out of a sense of guilt, a shack to live in, but she didn't look after him. She didn't come and clean it or do anything for him. She simply let him live there because she felt she had to do something for him. His life was winding down, relentlessly, and he was drowning in feelings of futility. And then God called him. Now, strange why God does what he does. I don't always understand why God calls some people who seem to have a lot of handicaps physically, or people perhaps who have gone through a lot of rough things in life and have these barriers and whatever. But God's calling is without repentance, and those whom God calls we accept in the church. But sometimes you initially think, boy, wouldn't it have been easier if God hadn't called this person. But God does. And those whom he calls are of his choice. First time I went to see Ken Russell, I knew his mind had been opened, and I knew God was calling him, but deep down I almost wished that God was not. I could tell from the color of his skin he was an alcoholic. I could tell from the way he talked and the look in his eyes that he wasn't completely sober during the visit. And all the signs were there. And at that point he was almost 80, and he looked like he was 85. But his mind was open. Through the haze of all the booze, he had begun to see certain things. He had proven to himself that God's laws must be kept. He had begun to keep the Sabbath. I told Mr. Russell, I said, if you get off the booze and if you are sober for one full month, I will invite you to services. But I said, I can't invite you to church the way you are right now. You got to prove to me that you're going to get off of this. And if you can hang on for a month, I said, I'll get you to church. And I went away on the assumption that he would never be able to do that, that he couldn't and wouldn't, and I would go back and find him in the same state, and that would be the end of that. I went back a month later, and he had been sober exactly 1 month, you see. He did it. I had made a promise, and I invited him to church. I got a local deacon to drive him to services, and suddenly, over a period of a couple of weeks, this little old man with the tired, sad eyes began to change. Now, two things, of course, helped him change, two reasons why. God's Spirit, which he received after he was baptized a few months later, helped him to change. And I recognize that. I'm not diminishing that. In addition, the brethren began to honor him. I asked several people to do that, and a lot of people did. And honor always changes the elderly, no matter what the age, in a very dramatic way. I remember well the day he was baptized. We sat in my living room before he was baptized, and he told me his life's history. And his life was a rather checkered kind of a life. not the kind of a life you or I would want to have lived. He began to ride the rails back in the 30s, and though many of you don't realize it, some people still ride the rails. He kept on riding the rails into the 50s. But in the late 40s, he'd gotten a job. He'd been riding the rails, had been a hobo, and in 1949, he got dumped off a freight train in Palm Springs, California. He wasn't from California, but that's where the freight, they found him in there and told him to get off. And he was wandering around the street in Palm Springs panhandling. He was offered a job working for a contractor putting in swimming pools. Now, back in the late 40s, Palm Springs had just begun to hit, you know, a certain level of prosperity, and everybody out there was putting in a swimming pool. That was it was a big time for pools. And he got a job. His main job was putting in these little mosaic, colored mosaic tiles all along the top of the rim of the pools. In Southern California, people will put in these pretty decorative tiles. And they make it look fancier, and I guess Ken Russell got pretty good at putting in those tiles. And he worked there for about 4 years, basically stayed sober during those 4 years, the late 40s. In 1952, he fell off the wagon, he went back to the booze, and he stayed pretty well pickled for almost 30 years until God began to call him. And then through the haze, in the early 80s, Ken Russell began to see that he had to change his life. He was almost 80 at the time, as I told you. Well, Ken Russell told me all this sitting in my living room the day I was going to baptize him. I hadn't heard his life story, but he told me about the mosaic tiles and all of that. And after the hour and a half conversation, it was time to take him out in the back of my house to baptize him. It so happens that because I was living then in San Bernardino County, which is out on the edge of the desert, I also had a swimming pool in the back of my house. It doesn't make me rich. It just means, you know, if you to take 110 degree heat 3 months out of the year, most people do have a pool. And I did, and that's where I did my baptisms. I took Mr. Russell down into the pool, and as we were going into the pool, I noticed that he glanced at the mosaic tile all around the rim of my pool. And I saw his eye, expert eye, sort of analyzing them. Well, we baptized him and came out of the pool. And sat on the edge on the side of it after he changed his clothing and after the laying on of hands, and we talked. And while we were talking, he again glanced down at the pool, and specifically at the tiles, the mosaic tiles along the edge, and he commented to me that the tiles along the rim of my pool hadn't been put in very well. And he said, you know, if I'd done that job, he said, with the expertise I picked up back in the 40s, he said, I would have done a really good job, and your pool would really look really nice. And I looked at him and I said, well, Mr. Russell, I wish you could have put in the tiles along the rim of my pool. I said, I know you would have done an excellent job. And he beamed, you see. He beamed. And you began to understand why he beamed. Maybe you're putting a few things together, I hope. He beamed. First time I'd ever seen Ken Russell smile that broadly. He had begun to smile a little bit after he came to church, but this was more on beyond smiling. Beaming is more than smiling. I think you know what I mean. You see, I had honored him and shown him a little respect for something which he had done. In the conversation that day, I learned something about Ken Russell's life. I had found out that there were areas of his life that were honorable areas. You see, when the Bible says honor the face of the old man, you got to find out something in their lives to honor them for. Ken Russell didn't have a lot of honorable things in his life, but he had a few. One was mosaic tiles, you see. And I could pick that out. I could give him honor for that. It was validating to him. It gave him a sense of having accomplished at least something of worth on a physical, professional level in this human life. And he appreciated that. He needed that. Well, he did a lot of things over the next couple of years. He joined Spokesman's Club for a while. Men in their 80s often have very interesting speeches to give. He gave some very interesting speeches. I remember his icebreaker. He talked a lot about panhandling. He talked a lot about booze. He talked a lot about what it does to you. And he also talked a lot about mosaic tiles. And I could have run up and kissed this guy that gave his did the evaluation, because I was sitting there thinking, I hope this guy picks out what Mr. Russell is doing, picks out the mosaic tiles and says something positive and complimentary and validating in his evaluation about the tiles. And this, I remember, forget it, a young guy from San Bernardino in his early 20s. I don't know how he knew, but he knew, and he did it. He hit the nail on the head, and he spent half of his time talking about mosaic tiles and you know what an excellent profession that is. And he'd seen tiles being that had been put in Palm Springs, and he was sure that Ken Russell probably had done it because they were well done. It was great. It was great. And he even embroidered a little bit, I'm sure, but it was good. For 2 years that he lived, the church, the congregation showered him with respect and with attention of all kinds. Ladies brought him whole wheat bread. His diet got so much better because people would bring him food. A local deacon would take him shopping. Some of the singles would take him shopping, and that's something to think about. Parents told their kids to call him Grandpa Russell. He'd never had any grandchildren that hadn't shown him any affection. He had some, but they didn't like him because he was just an old wino in their eyes. The church brethren didn't view him in that focus, you see. So all the little kids called him Grandpa Russell. He responded to the honor, and he flourished, and he began to smile a lot, and he had two wonderful happy years. Happy years. Then one day his liver that had been, you know, devastated by all these years of booze simply stopped functioning. And I went to the hospital, to the intensive care ward, to talk to him about 6 hours before he died. And we talked about his life. He knew he was dying. And it's, I think, significant to me when people in the Church of God, elderly people, not the young, who sometimes are a little frightened, but the elderly are dying and they have finished the course. And honor has been given. They really then want to pass their life in review. And it's not from the point of view of hanging on to it. It simply is from the point of view of, you know, tying up the last loose strings. And he wanted to do that. It was not done in an atmosphere of fear or anxiety. He talked about the resurrection. He talked about what it would be like when he woke up in the resurrection. It was the way it really ought to be. And we talked a lot about his past life. There was still a need for completion, but it was the final phase of the completion or closure process, you see. We discussed his wife he hadn't seen in 30 years, and he asked me if I would contact her and tell her that he had passed away, and I said that I would. We talked about his grandchildren. We talked about Spokesman's Club and about his 2 years in the church and all that had happened. We also talked about mosaic tiles. You see, it was simply a part of what he needed and what I was commanded to give to him. And it's sort of interesting. I told him for the last time, I mean, just scant really minutes before he died, maybe an hour, hour and a half, that it would have been great if he could have put in those colored mosaic tiles around the rim of my swimming pool. And he beamed. If you don't think people can beam on their deathbed, you haven't seen people, elderly people, who are ready and willing and accepting, you see, who have completed the course, can have an incredibly wonderful and accepting positive reaction, even though they know there are only minutes, perhaps hours left. He beamed. In the closing minutes of his life, he could still respond to honor, and it was important to him that I do that. Now, he knew I would. You see, by that time, he'd figured things out. He knew if he brought up mosaic tile that I would respond to it, and it was like a little game. And we carried it out. I want you to see something in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. We did something for Ken Russell. He died in a good old age. He would have died otherwise in a bad old age. He would have had two horrendous, awful last years of life in futility, feeling frustrated with himself, frustrated with life, unfulfilled. We turned it around. To me, that is awfully exciting. We gave him two wonderful years, and honor was a major component in that occurring. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, notice what it says about David. Thus David, the son of Jesse, reigned over all of Israel, and the time that he reigned over Israel was 40 years. Notice verse 28 in 1 Chronicles 29, he died in a good old age. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 28, he died in a good old age. That we must then conclude that you can die in a bad old age. You see, you can die in futility. You can die feeling that life was not worth living. You can also die in a good old age. Notice it's defined here. What is a good old age? Full of days, not in the 40s or 50s, but this is the 70s and the 80s. Full of days, riches as a result of accomplishment, and notice, full of, because it's repeated on each of these, full of honor. A good old age is an old age full of honor. Have you consciously ever honored the face of an elderly person in your entire life? How many times do you honor the face of your grandparents, all of those who put your hand up? How often do you do that? Chances are some of you never have. Maybe this can come back at this juncture, you see, to singles and the launching stage in life, those of you in your 20s, 30s, and early 40s who are still sort of launching. If you don't serve, if you do not fulfill some of these responsibilities, you do cut yourself off from certain specific blessings in your opportunities, you see, to be successful in life, to have God's blessing on those things that you choose to do, jobs, whatever, marriages, the whole thing. You then limit them. You then limit those opportunities, and you limit the blessings. How do you honor? Well, there are a lot of different ways. You can take elderly people on outings. That's a wonderful thing to do. And sometimes half an hour a day, just driving around Pasadena, looking at things, looking at the house he used to live in over on Hill years and years ago when they first came to Pasadena. He would drive around town, and he enjoyed looking at the city that he knew so well. Drives are nice. You can offer to take him shopping. Elderly people sometimes will become confused. Supermarkets are complicated places. And, prices change. New brands of food come out. They don't know much about the new brands. You can take them shopping and simplify that particular thing. But don't be patronizing. Please don't patronize people of age. They know when you're doing that, and that is not appreciated. Letters are wonderful. But in the letters, tell them about yourself, but ask them about themselves. You see the key here? We tend to write to Grandpa. And we tell Grandpa about us, and he's interested, but that doesn't give him honor. You give him honor when you ask him in your letter about him. Ask him about, what it was like when he came out to Southern California, if this is where he's living now, back in 1922. Ask him what it was like when he and your grandmother got married. Ask him what it was like to have little kids back in the 30s. Ask him what it was like when he was launching, and validate what he did. That's how you show him honor. But the main way, of course, is to talk to them and to focus when you talk to them face to face on their accomplishments in life, because their need, you see, is closure. You're launching, their need is closure. Honor is a part of that. To bring meaning into the life that would never be there otherwise. I got to tell you quickly about an unforgettable experience when I was a senior in Bricklywood, England in 1960, which confirms what I've just been saying. During that year, that was 1960-61, the first year of the college, between classes, I was a senior then, Guy Engelbart and I used to work in the business office. In fact, we did 90% of what was done in the business office, because the business office was very small in England in those days. Because of the limited outreach of the British work, there was not a lot to do. We read all the mail, but that was 10 to 15 letters a day. That was all the mail from the British Isles, English-speaking Europe, and West Africa, 10 to 15 letters a day. So we'd divide it up. He'd get 8 and I'd get 8, or he'd get 8 and I'd get 9. Someone would always get the extra one if it was an odd number of letters. We would then type up names on envelopes if people asked for literature. We would go out and find a typewriter, and if they asked for the booklet on faith or water baptism, we would type their name on a little piece of paper and stick it on the envelope, and then go and get the literature and put that in the envelope and put a stamp on the envelope and put it in the mailbox. We did all of that. It was a very small operation, very small work in the UK in those days. And if a visit request came in, which was rare, once every couple of months, after we stopped doing a little dance around the office, because this was such an incredible occasion, he and I, this was part of our job too as students, we would jump in the little green College Anglia, little tiny car. People used to call them pregnant skates. They were little tiny, tiny little cars, very small. And we would zoom out wherever they were in the British Isles to see these people. And we would go 2, 3, 4 hours almost to the Scottish.